Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI speaks of ecumenism during a visit to the German Lutheran Church in Rome after continuing in his Lenten reflections in St. Peter's Square. Zimbabwe's year-old unity government fails to live up to its promises as one party's refusal to share power and collaborate defeats its very purpose. And film critic Peter Malone tells us about a moving and uplifting film about a southern African country that did manage to overturn a regime of cruelty and injustice. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday visited the German Lutheran Church in Rome for evening worship services. The invitation to the Pope was made in 2008 on the 25th anniversary of Pope John Paul II's visit to the same church. During his homily, Benedict spoke of the state of ecumenism. Charles Collins has this report.
Pope Benedict is no stranger to Rome's Lutheran Church. As a cardinal, he went to the church in 1998 to debate with the Lutheran Bishop of Berlin on the theme Personal Perspectives, Ecumenical Experiences, Positions, and Expectations. A year later, Catholics and Lutherans issued a joint statement on justification, helping to heal one of the chief theological rifts which led to the Reformation. The then Cardinal Ratzinger was instrumental in working out the language of the document. In his remarks to the 350 people gathered in the small church, the Pope again spoke about ecumenism. He said both sides have accused each other of slowing down the ecumenical movement, but that only God, not man, could create true unity. The Pope, speaking in German, said he thinks we should first be thankful that there is so much unity. He noted that it's good that we can pray together, sing the same hymns together, hear the same word of God together, that we can interpret and try to understand it together. The Holy Father said only God could create more unity among Christians because a unity we negotiate ourselves would be man-made and as fragile as everything that man makes. He concluded by saying that for Christians, division cannot be the starting point. Instead, it should be the joy and hope in which we live. I'm Charles Collins.
And early on Sunday, Pope Benedict said the gospel parable of the prodigal son speaks powerfully of God and lets us know his face, and better yet, his heart. Charles Collins again has more.
Pope Benedict is speaking before the Angelus prayer in St. Peter's Square on the fourth Sunday of Lent.
Today's gospel presents the touching parable of the prodigal son. Jesus invites us to trust in the Father's infinite mercy and to return to him with hearts purified by repentance. Through our Lenten observance and the reception of the sacraments of penance and the Eucharist, may we grow in sorrow for our sins and discover new the Father's loving embrace.
He said after Jesus revealed the merciful love of the Father, everything changed. Now we know God is our Father who created us free to love and gave us a consciousness that suffers if we get lost and that celebrates if we return. The Pope explained the relationship with God is built through a story, similar to what happens to every child with their parents. At the beginning, he depends on them. Then he claims his own autonomy. And finally, he comes to a mature relationship based on genuine gratitude and love. The Holy Father said in these stages we can read even moments of the journey of man in relationship with God. There is a phase that is like childhood, a religion provoked by need, by dependence. Gradually, man grows and is emancipated. He wants to free himself from the submission and become free, adult, able to regulate himself and make his own choices independently, to the point of even thinking he can do without God. This phase, indeed, is a delicate one and can lead to atheism. Fortunately, God never fails in his loyalty, and even if we move away and get lost, he continues to follow us with his love, forgiving our mistakes and speaking to our inner consciousness to call us back to him. The Pope concluded by saying, "Only by experiencing forgiveness, recognizing ourselves as loved with a free love, will we finally enter into a truly filial and free relationship with God."
Thanks there to Charles Collins for those reports. John Stewart lives and works in Harare, the capital city of Zimbabwe. He's been there since 1980, and even before that, has lived in Africa for 90% of his life. His work right now is for an organisation called Nonviolent Action for Social Change, that provides technical and practical skills for negotiation, mediation, and nonviolent action. It was set up in 1999 with the help of Miserio, an organization of the Catholic Church in Germany. He also works with the South African Dennis Hurley Peace Institute, which promotes and supports the work the Catholic Church does for peace in Africa. Sounds like a good person to speak to about the dramatic situation in Zimbabwe, where 1 year from the signing of a national unity government, poverty and unemployment are still rife, the press is not free, and human rights are abused on a daily basis.
Zimbabwe is a very complicated country.
I managed to reach John Stewart over the telephone after reading an extraordinarily clear and focused report he had written on the current political situation.
It's a country with a population of just over 10 million. And it's a small country. It's got an area of about 400,000 square kilometers. A country where education has been very important and people are generally very well educated. There's a high literacy rate. At the end of the 1990s, it was said that the literacy rate was about 97%. Unfortunately, education is one of the areas which has really suffered because teachers were seen during the period of the last 10 years in the extreme polarization, the division that the country has seen. Teachers were seen as a major potential threat to the people who are the rulers of, or have been the rulers of the country.
And so many teachers, he told me, left the profession or left the country.
But still, education has been an important feature, and In many ways, Zimbabweans are very able to handle their issues in a calm way. But at the same time, because of the way in which the rule of a group of people who came to power in 1980 after an armed liberation war, after that group began to discover that their popularity was waning but wished to stay in power, they began to threaten anyone who challenged them.
John Stewart, of course, is referring to the current president, Robert Mugabe, and his ZANU-PF party.
So the last 10 years has been a difficult time, increasingly difficult as the years have gone by, with a lot of violations of many people's rights. People who do public types of protest, people like trade unions or student organizations, people with whom I've done a lot of work, have been directly victimized. I myself have not been very directly victimized. I have been threatened in various ways. I've had very short periods of detention after meetings or overnight.
But the real challenge now, he says, is to get the parties that form the country's year-old unity government, namely the ZANU-PF, led by Mugabe, and the former opposition movement for democratic change, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, to support the full implementation of the global political agreement that should set the basis for economic rebirth and free and fair elections in 2011.
I Robert Gabriel Mugabe, President of the Republic of Zimbabwe, do hereby call upon you, Morgan Richard Tsvangirai, to take the oaths as prescribed by law.
I, Morgan Richard Tsvangirai, being chosen and admitted to Cabinet of Zimbabwe, do swear that I will, to the best of my judgment, at all times when so required, freely give my counsel and advice to the President of Zimbabwe for the good management of the public affairs of Zimbabwe. So help me God.
The main problem, John Stewart says, is that Mugabe and his men refuse to share power and continue to intimidate their opponents and muzzle the press. Mr. Stewart, you speak very clearly and in very calm tones, but these past 10 years especially, as you have been saying, have also meant that conditions, living conditions in Zimbabwe for most Zimbabweans have been very difficult, very dramatic. At least 3 million Zimbabweans have fled the country, and those left have had to deal with a lot of violence, intimidation, lack of infrastructures.
The situation has been extremely dramatic in various ways. Food production has plummeted from a time when in the late 1990s, Zimbabwe exported food and was thought of as the breadbasket of Southern Africa, to a situation where food production is about a quarter of the country's needs now. That's one kind of dramatic decline. The health and education systems declined absolutely. The health system was basically not working at all, just begun to recover in the last 12 months. But until the agreement of the end of 2008, health and education were extremely problematic. One of the most dramatic ways that people were impoverished was the fact that the value of the local money just evaporated. We had inflation, which was in the millions of percent during the middle years of 2005 and 2006, but reached the billions and even larger numbers, trillions of percent by 2008 and early 2009. So that money had no value. But at the same time, there was a small group of people, those who ruled the country, who lived extremely well and who were in positions where the wealth of the country, because it is a rich country in terms of minerals and other resources, the wealth was taken over by a small group of people, perhaps 1,000 people.
So those who could, Mr. Stewart said, left the country.
I think the numbers are contested, but one estimate that I hear of is that there are more than 4 million Zimbabweans outside the country, or about between 35 and 40% of the population. The kinds of indicators that we've seen of impoverishment, of displacement, of economic decline are the indicators of war. This kind of collapse of a society really only happens in a situation of war. But what's been a bit strange about the situation of Zimbabwe is it's never really been called a war, even though it was a kind of war against the people by the ruling elite. And one of the ironies of the present moment is what we're involved in, or what we're trying to be involved in with great difficulty, is the work of post-conflict recovery. And it's a bit ironic to say you're doing post-conflict recovery when you haven't previously admitted that you have a major conflict.
Now, the main tenets of the global political agreement would be a spirit of cooperation and of joint work to deal with the healing of the country because of the years of past divisions, and to tackle issues such as writing a new constitution and sowing the seeds of economic recovery. But that's just not happening.
I think I'd like to just use a quotation from a former cabinet minister of Zimbabwe who said a few years ago, his name was Edison Zwobgo, and he was a minister of justice and other things, but his phrase was, ZANU will tolerate anything to happen unless it threatens its hold on power. And when that process threatens its hold on power, it will do anything to stop it. So what seems to be in the case is ZANU entered into the process thinking that it would not be challenged in its ability to hold on to power, but then gradually realized that to be into this process in real good faith would actually be a process leading to their loss of power. And so in particular, in the last 4 months or so, they've begun to prevent many of the processes continuing as they might have done.
So, for example, both the national healing process and the constitutional process have been delayed and diverted. And none of the progress that could have allowed the opening of Zimbabwe to international assistance has been made.
One discussion I've heard is that we should not really call ourselves a highly indebted poor country, but a highly robbed poor country, because actually the wealth of the country has been diverted into the hands of people who have nominally been its governors, its rulers. One particular case of this is the very major alluvial diamond field that was discovered a number of years ago in eastern Zimbabwe, which some people refer to as the largest diamond field discovered in the last 30 years. But it's been entirely taken over by the kind of grouping that is both political and military around the ZANU elite. And so this is a wealth that should be for the needs of the country, but is taken for the interests of a few.
I'd like to ask you a personal question. I mean, you've stuck it out for so many years, and I know it must be very, very difficult also to witness one's own country go through such suffering. What is your hope, and what do you think may actually happen in the next few years?
My hope is based on knowing a huge number of people who are determined and eager to do work that is work of healing and reconstruction and recovery, including to do the work of talking to those who've caused the hurt and trying to build bridges with such people. In just a very personal historical note, that in 1951, my father chaired the Catholic Federation of Students in South Africa, and one of his committee members was Robert Gabriel Mugabe. So I've had a number of meetings, but not since 15 years now, with the man himself. But there are many other levels of possible encounter. So my hope is that there will be a real chance of healing and of the reparations and restitution that people who have been victims do deserve.
John Stewart also says there are good signs in small projects carried out by the Catholic Justice and Peace Commission and other groups, where victims and perpetrators are brought together with some very positive and affirming results.
So my hope is that there will be a kind of healing. It's going to be a long and slow process to do complete healing. And it's something which is going to demand very new and very innovative work, especially from the churches. I think that a lot of the conclusions, I think what they were called, the propositions from the Synod of the Universal Church on Africa, are extremely important to be realized in Zimbabwe, especially those relating to peace and reconciliation and justice. But I think the complexity is going to remain this discussion between the issues between justice and peace. To not forget justice when we're trying to work for peace, but also to not forget peace if we're just working for justice. And so I think this is something that we are, and Zimbabwean church and other organizations are aware of. It's really this question of finding a breakthrough, a way to take the step towards all the work of a transition and recovery. And that's where the pressure of international attention and presence still is needed. But my real hope and sense is that we are not very far from the beginning of the recovery. But once it's begun, it will have a whole lot of new challenges, and those are unforeseeable at this time.
So, let's not forget the people of Zimbabwe. Let's keep the international pressure of attention and presence on Zimbabwe's rulers so that that breakthrough can finally be made. And maybe someday in the future, that beautiful country will return to be known as the breadbasket of Southern Africa. And now it's over to my friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Staying in Southern Africa today, he talks about a moving and uplifting film about a country that did manage to overturn a regime of cruelty and injustice, thanks also to the vision and to the courage of an extraordinary man called Nelson Mandela. The film, you've probably already guessed, is Invictus.
I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
It's a very moving film, though I was surprised that a lot of critics didn't like it at all. And I was trying to work out why, because the people that I saw it with were very moved, a number of critics as well. And it's this big problem about portraying goodness, that somehow or other people want such conflict that when you present a good character and very positive story, they think it's not dramatic enough, and so they don't review it well.
So let's tell our listeners who maybe don't know Invictus that it's the story of Nelson Mandela and the new South Africa, right?
It is.
How it began, let's say.
It begins very well, actually, giving a summary of Nelson Mandela's life up to the time of his release. And it does it very effectively in using a kind of television news format, even though Morgan Freeman is actually acting the part of Mandela, which makes it seem as if you're watching real newsreel and you accept Morgan Freeman as Mandela right from the start.
Today, President Mandela takes office in Pretoria, balancing black aspirations with white fears.
And he gives such a powerful performance all the way through that it's a bit of a shock during the final credits to see the real Mandela. But they're very similar.
It seems to be a very inspiring film.
It is. We better add that it's a football film and it's a rugby union film, which is an unusual topic for a film to be screened in the United States. And during the film, somebody does remark, you know, apropos of soccer being called football, that it's a gentleman's game played by thugs and hooligans, whereas rugby union is a hooligan's game played by gentlemen.
That's a very appropriate description.
Yes, it really looks rough and tumble, the scenes of the final match, because Mandela was very shrewd and he didn't want to alienate the white people who had been in power in the apartheid years. And so he found that South Africa hosting the Rugby Union World Cup in 1995 could be an occasion to bring black and white people together.
Brothers, sisters, this is the time to build our nation.
And also having a very strong rugby team, the Springbok team has always been one of the best in the world. Why not capitalize on that?
All of the whites are cheering for South Africa. All of the blacks are cheering for England. How long before the World Cup?
And so he decides then that if the Springboks perform reasonably well, then that could be a great uniting factor in the country. In fact, they are so inspired by Mandela and by their captain, played by Matt Damon.
I've been invited to tea.
With who?
The president.
That they actually not only do well, they get through to the final.
Tell me, Francois, how do we inspire ourselves to greatness when nothing less will do? How do we inspire everyone around us?
And that is true history.
It is.
I see here you say that the film is based on a book by a journalist called John Carlin, entitled Playing the Enemy.
Yes. There was some criticism by other journalists that differed from his perspective. But I read an article by one of them who didn't like the author, but he said somehow or other the film moved him very much, and I gather that people in South Africa have also been very moved by Invictus.
From what I can see, it's a number of things that come together. It's the figure of this extraordinary man, shots of a sport, of a well-played sport like rugby, do arouse emotion, and also the music that's been chosen to accompany the film. It's South African music. It's throbbing, very heartfelt, emotional music. I think altogether, how can it not move?
This rugby is a political calculation.
It is a human calculation.
According to the experts, we'll reach the quarterfinals and no further.
According to the experts, you and I should still be in jail.
Times change. We need to change as well.
Well, that's true, and it's symbolised, I think, by the various times that Nelson Mandela himself goes onto the football field and is acclaimed by the crowds. You can just feel that unity and the inspiration that follows from that.
Do you hear? Listen to your country. This is it. This is our destiny.
You start your review saying Invictus means unconquered, and you also quote a poem that Nelson Mandela, you say, relied on during his 27 years in prison on Robben Island. And this poem is quoted during the film as well, isn't it?
Yes, especially that he is the captain of his soul and will not be bowed and bloodied.
I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
I hadn't come across the poem before, but in the context of the film, it reads rather well, which is why I thought it was best to put the whole text of the poem in the review.
Do you think it's also interesting historically? I mean, it's recent history, and most people know what happened in South Africa, but do you think it's an interesting glimpse at what society was like at that time in South Africa and how things did begin to change?
It is. You realise that, you know, a lot of things still have to change, and that's emphasised in the film. But with Mandela still alive, he still brings that period very vividly to mind, because even in his 90s, he is still there and a symbol of what was achieved when it all seemed impossible.
That was Peter Malone, head of the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.